491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California to New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 328, recorded on Sunday, October 11th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel, and welcome back.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
So this week, we're going to be talking about traffic stops and the origins of traffic laws around cars in this country, in the United States. We ended up deciding we're not going to go into a huge amount of detail about the historical origins on this one for reasons that I think will become evident as we progress through this episode. And we'll also probably want to come back in a future episode to talk about bicycles more specifically. But there's two big reasons to cover the topic that we're going to be doing on this episode this year. First of all, earlier in the year, when the number of COVID-19 fatalities in the U.S. was much lower, many conservative commentators dismissively remarked that the fatality count was lower than the number of vehicular deaths in the U.S. each year, which raised some obvious questions about why we allow so many of those deaths as well. Second, the role of traffic stops in incidents of violent police interactions with the populace and the apparent lack of a link between traffic stops and actual traffic safety has been gaining more attention amid protests around policing in general, given that there are 20 million police traffic stops per year in the U.S. and 50,000 per day. And I myself, as some of you know, have gotten into hot water in the past for criticizing the practice of police high-speed pursuits and the fatalities that result, although I believe the data still supports my position. Traffic safety policy is a huge topic, but we've narrowed it down for today's purposes to a few themes that seemed most relevant to our show and to this year. So first, let's rewind to the beginning of automotive traffic laws in the United States at the turn of the last century, and then let's talk about police traffic enforcement more specifically in the present day. So Rachel, could you talk to us about when we started getting automotive traffic laws in the United States and how they have evolved since then?
Yeah, so I guess in the beginning, so about the 1900s, streets were really seen as a public thoroughfare for everyone using all modes of transportation. So there were streetcars, pedestrians, bicyclists, horse-drawn wagons, and then the cars kind of came along. And pretty quickly, there started being tussles between motorists and people using other modes of transportation. So I think cars used to scare horses, which would cause problems. And in the beginning, there were a lot of traffic fatalities with associated with pedestrians. And this was really seen as the fault of the motorist. The motorist was too cavalier, too dangerous, and just weren't acting responsibly in keeping an eye out for pedestrians and really sharing the common space of the street. In the 1920s, according to a Salon article that's citing the Detroit News, upwards of 60% of automobile-related fatalities were children under the age of 9. And by the close of the 1920s, automobiles had claimed the lives of more than 250,000 children and adults in the United States. I found a kind of timeline, a traffic timeline from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and they kind of detailed some of the milestones in traffic safety and laws. So in 1901, Connecticut enacted the first speed limit law. It was 12 miles per hour in the city and 15 miles per hour on country roads. In 1910, the first drunk driving law was introduced in New York. In 1930, the modern three-way traffic light, the red, yellow, green that we're all familiar with, was introduced in the U.S. And then another big milestone is in 1960, the Department of Transportation was established. And I wanted to highlight their motto: to ensure our nation has the safest, most efficient, and modern transportation system in the world that improves the quality of life for all American people, which seems to ring fairly hollow today, especially when you look at our traffic system, our transit systems compared to like other developed nations.
Yeah, it's not safe, it's not modern, it's not efficient.
Absolutely not. And our quality of life has definitely suffered for it. In 1970, the Highway Safety Act creates the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. So the Department of Transportation and the NHTSA really work together to establish safety standards for vehicles and also to encourage states to change their laws. So the safety standards are kind of outside the scope of this episode, but I kind of wanted to highlight that. In 1974, there was a nationwide speed limit of 55 miles per hour, which it's kind of hard to imagine having a nationwide speed limit that low, but I think we would all be much, much safer if it was still in place today. In 1978, Tennessee enacted a car seat / booster seat law for children. They had to be in the appropriate safety restraints. In 1984, New York enacts the first seatbelt law, requiring seatbelts in passenger vehicles. In 1998, in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, there was a 0.02 blood alcohol content law enacted for minors. This is also known as a zero tolerance law. So basically, if a minor takes more than like a dose of cough syrup, you're probably going to get busted for a DUI. In 2000, all states had to enact a 0.08 blood alcohol content law by 2004 or lose highway funding. And this is kind of the stick that is kind of dangled in front of the states. Like, there's often a threat to lose highway funding if they don't comply with changing their laws. This also happened in 1984 when all 50 states were forced to adopt an alcohol purchase law of 21, or highway funding would be reduced by 10%. They had to do it by mid-1986. However, Idaho didn't actually raise theirs until 1987. And apparently South Dakota and Wyoming were the last two states to kind of hold out, which doesn't really surprise me given kind of the Mountain West, Great Plains sort of ethos. And also my last big milestone is in 2003, there was a 50 state click it or ticket campaign, encouraging use of seatbelts in passenger vehicles, which is kind of funny because, as Bill pointed out before we started recording, New Hampshire does not have any laws requiring seatbelt usage. So I think it's kind of funny that they have this campaign, but is absolutely toothless. So something else I wanted to point out was kind of the change in seeing motorists as dangers and kind of cavalier kind of jaybirds showing off to kind of the masters of the road. So as I pointed out in there's a Salon article talking about the secret history of jaywalking, and that's where I got those traffic fatality statistics that I mentioned earlier. And something else I wanted to mention was that in 1923, Cincinnati residents wanted to pursue an ordinance that would require motorists to outfit their cars with mechanical devices called governors. These governors would switch off car engines if vehicles exceeded speeds of 25 miles per hour. And this caused automobile dealers to mobilize to strike down the measure. And over the next decade, the auto industry pursued aggressive action to take sole possession of public roads and, in turn, reshape the conversation around cars. The American Automobile Association, or AAA, sponsors safety campaigns in schools, educating students on the dangers of crossing the street in unmarked zones. Boy Scouts handed out cards to pedestrians, warning them against the practice of jaywalking. mock trials were conducted in public settings to shame or ridicule offenders. The National Automobile Chamber of Commerce persuaded politicians and journalists to shill for their cause. The Packard Motor Car Company went so far as to construct tombstones engraved with the name Mr. J. Walker. In Buffalo, beachgoers were treated to a public performance by the National Safety Council, in which a jaywalker was arrested, handcuffed, and fitted with a sandwich board that read, "I am a jaywalker," and then ushered into a police wagon plastered with anti-pedestrian slogans, such as, "Hell is paved with good intentions, but why crowd the place? Don't jaywalk." By the 1930s, jaywalking had been adopted as common law in most major municipalities. The term was near ubiquitous, and opposition to the automobile had softened to scarcely a whisper. So there was this really big sea change in the 1920s and 1930s that really shaped how we view cars and how we view pedestrians that has really endured until this day. A lot of times if you read about pedestrians getting struck by cars, there's a lot of questions of what were they doing? Were they distracted? What were they wearing? How dark was it? Were they wearing reflective clothing? Did they have headlamps? I've seen some people suggest that pedestrians need to wear headlamps after dark. And it's really putting the blame on pedestrians for daring to exist where motorists ought to be and where they really belong.
We can also see the sort of evolution in perspectives. Because this wasn't immediately widely popular, there was quite a bit of resistance to the default assumption that everyone except the drivers was at fault. There was an interesting New York Times cartoon in 1922 called Sacrifices to the Modern Moloch, which depicted a reckless and vicious driver bowing down to a car that was labeled auto fatalities and was drawn to look like it was eating child sacrifices being offered up by this driver, sort of a very evocative perspective on that. But in any case, we are in the situation that we're in now. Obviously, there's been some changes in perspectives toward concepts like complete streets and shared streets and things like that in the modern era. We're not going to focus as much on that this week. Instead, we're going to talk more about the role of police, which Rachel did just talk about the emergence of the role of police as primary enforcement on relatively minor traffic-related offenses, including jaywalking, but also they are routinely used to try to address what we would argue as engineering problems that lead to unsafe driving behavior in a lot of cases. So according to the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Justice, the most common reason for contact with the police in the United States is being a driver in a traffic stop. If there were a way to eliminate that role, it would dramatically reshape the U.S. populace's interactions with police. And there's actually a number of things happening in Massachusetts this year that are good sort of case studies in terms of talking about the issue. So my colleagues on the Cambridge, Massachusetts City Council, both of whom I know at least a little bit, earlier this year proposed exploring making unarmed city employees the primary traffic enforcers pulling people over. They wrote in the draft of the policy that, quote, "the presence of an armed police officer during a routine traffic stop raises the tension of the encounter unnecessarily and can itself lead to conflict, causing harmful stress to both parties and damaging the relationship between police and the community," end quote. As always, arsenalfordemocracy.com will have a PDF up that has little links to all the different news articles and citations of what we're talking about today. However, in a demonstration of how challenging it is to explore this idea and to change the paradigm for policing in the U.S., the proposal still contemplated using police, quote, "for apprehending known criminals, dangerous or erratic drivers, and other related situations that clearly go beyond routine traffic enforcement," end quote. So then the question, of course, becomes what the dividing line is in terms of in the moment when you see someone driving past, how do you determine, oh, this is a dangerous or erratic driver, or this is a known criminal, and then what do you do with that if it's not for the unarmed employee? Do they decide that they can't pull someone over and need to call in the police, or would they be paired off with an armed police officer who's sitting next to them? How would you actually implement this? In Massachusetts, on the whole, the state briefly began collecting racial data on police traffic stops after legislation passed in the year 2000 and then allowed it to expire in the mid-2000s when it became embarrassingly clear that police traffic stops across the state were disproportionate for Black and Latino drivers. And yet the legislature continues to add legal reasons for police to pull over drivers in Massachusetts, such as distracted driving related to cell phones, without allowing new racial data collection. 2019 legislation on that issue required racial data to be collected at least in distracted driving stops where a citation was issued. But that's not all kinds of stops. It's not the other kinds of stops. And it's not even the stops that don't result in a citation. Public reporting, however, even on that narrow arena has not been forthcoming. A 2020 ruling by the state's Supreme Judicial Court ordered the legislature to require police to start producing those type of statistics. The majority opinion stated that, quote, this type of data collection would help to protect drivers from racially discriminatory traffic stops and also would help protect police officers who do not engage in such discriminatory stops, end quote. Massachusetts court opinions issued this year also allowed defendants who have been convicted of something related to a traffic stop to still be able to sue over certain things that occurred during the stop, such as racist treatment or police brutality. In one case at hand, yes, the driver was convicted of repeatedly operating a vehicle without a license and for having an unregistered gun in the car, but also it turned out that 80% of all drivers pulled over by the arresting officers were Black drivers, and the officers had not pulled him over for a driving violation that day, but rather had pulled him over after running his plates on a whim since he was driving a luxury vehicle past them, and they noticed an expired tag, and then they noticed other standing warrants, and then they followed and pulled him over. In a different case, police beat a man they had pulled over, and the court ordered that although he was pulled over for some real driving violations, he could still sue the police for beating him. Activists around the country this year have also pushed for state governments to curb so-called pretext stops, where minor traffic and driving offenses are considered sufficient primary reasons for police to pull over a vehicle, such as, quote, failure to signal, broken license plate light, tinted windows, end quote, or simply driving too slowly in a left lane on the highway. Pretext stops are known as such because they are disproportionately deployed in so-called high-crime areas due to explicit federal training to local law enforcement agencies to give a pretext for finding purported troublemakers and known criminals, and these were legalized by a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1996 unanimously in a decision written by Scalia. So you can think about who was on the U.S. Supreme Court at the time and joined that decision. Listeners may also recall that Congressman Joe Kennedy, a former prosecutor, in a 2018 interview with Ezra Klein for Vox, bemoaned marijuana legalization for removing a useful traffic stop and vehicle search pretext in Massachusetts, which was smelling marijuana wafting from a passing vehicle and then searching it for weapons after a traffic stop. So that was fairly controversial and I think did play at least some role in him losing his Senate challenge to Ed Markey. But this issue of pretext stops is a huge one, and it also gets into this issue of what is the difference between a primary violation and a secondary violation. A secondary violation is something that you can't get pulled over for, but they can give you a citation for or charge you for after they have pulled you over for something else. And it also gets into this issue, as Rachel is about to talk about, with an article in Counterpunch magazine about the issue of safety violations versus other related violations that don't actually have to do with the operation of the vehicle itself. So, Rachel, could you talk about the study from Albuquerque?
So, nationwide, about 1 in 8 people are pulled over annually by police, and among non-white people, it's about 1 in 4. So does any of this have any effect on traffic safety, let alone any of the purported community safety pretexts from these types of stops? The answer appears to be no. A 2020 study published in Counterpunch magazine looking at the first 1,000 non-criminal traffic cases filed this year in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which is a community of more than 500,000 people, and since 2014, a police force under long-term federal monitoring for civil rights violations, found that half the annual police budget went toward traffic enforcement, generating court fees and revenue and fines, but no apparent improvements in road safety. If you take the number of speeding violations, something most of us would consider at least a somewhat genuine road safety concern that can actually get people killed, and then double that number, that is still less than the combined number of citations issued in Albuquerque for problems with vehicle registration and vehicle insurance. In fact, speeding was only the third largest pool of citations. Failure to pay these tickets over registration and insurance and failure to appeal in court to contest them, all of which relate directly to poverty or inability to leave work or find childcare, escalate immediately to automatic license suspensions and standing arrest warrants for actual jail time. This all fuels a further cycle of driving violations, traffic stops, fines, and jail. Overwhelmingly, warrants were associated with those secondary types of technical violations rather than to primary violations directly related to some kind of unsafe driving that a police officer noticed. A different study elsewhere by the Rochester Institute of Technology confirmed those poverty-related reasons for many drivers' secondary violations and their subsequent inability to pay the fines or go to court to contest them. Many drivers also mentioned that they were forced to drive without or on suspended licenses due to the lack of public transit. Bench warrants can also cost people their jobs and force them out of public benefits that would help keep them from sliding deeper into poverty. So it just becomes this really vicious cycle just based on these like standing warrants and standing tickets, unpaid traffic tickets. So then it's really not making any effect on public safety or traffic safety at all.
Now, when most people think about abstractly about the concept of police enforcement in terms of traffic issues, they are thinking about things like speeding. They're thinking about things like drunk driving and more recently distracted driving with cell phones, that sort of thing. But as was illustrated in the Albuquerque example and what seems to be backed up by other places as well, is that those actual primary safety-related violations such as speeding, which is, in fact, one of the top three causes of fatal U.S. crashes and which dramatically increases the chance of death with each additional amount of excess speed, doesn't really get affected much either way by police enforcement, even though that's what we think of them as doing. And that's what, you know, I, as a city councilor, sometimes I will have constituents say, can I get a police officer deployed to this particular area to, you know, monitor for speeding and ticket people for speeding, because they assume that that is actually going to have an effect. There's not a whole lot of evidence that it particularly does. And for the most part, if we want safer streets with fewer vehicular deaths and injuries, we really just need to have better design and engineering that naturally discourages unsafe driving. Having more enforcement by police is not going to accomplish what we want it to. For issues like failure to comply with seatbelt laws, which is another top three U.S. crash fatality cause, or helmet laws or distracted driving laws, we should be exploring those unarmed non-police enforcement concepts like they're looking at in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's a few other notes that I'll just leave in the notes but won't read on air just so that we don't go over time. But Rachel, I will go to you for your sort of concluding wrap-up thoughts on everything that we've discussed today.
So I think the tide of sentiment is kind of turning. And I think a lot of people who are pedestrians or cyclists or engage in those other modes of transportation are really starting to have their voices heard. And I just want to encourage, talking about the engineering side of things, to kind of look at the hashtag Vision Zero, which is about traffic safety. And there's a lot of people on like the traffic department side that are just kind of doing the same old dance about talking about distracted pedestrians, blah, blah, blah. But then there's a lot of people pushing back using that hashtag. And I think it's really interesting to look at the engineering side of things and people talking about solutions that would actually reduce traffic fatalities, not just the usual. Everybody needs to look and everybody needs to share the road and be nice and stuff. I think looking at those actual root causes is super important. And it's really eye-opening. I've learned a lot over the past just couple years, just learning about road design and how kind of hostile roads are for pedestrians and cyclists.
And as you explored earlier in the episode, this is not how it had to be necessarily. This is not what roads were originally envisioned as. I mean, obviously, we didn't get into the fact that there were certainly plenty of children that were ground up underneath a horse-drawn carriage owned by a rich person. That was obviously a frequent spark for class tensions and riots in various places. But there used to be more of a sense that the roads were, in fact, for everyone. And before the automotive age, people would just simply walk a lot of places, or at least before the trolley era. You know, and the prevalence of commuter type rail service, people would just walk various places. That was a common thing. You would, you know, walk on various country paths and roads and things like that, and that's how you would get around. And it was expected that, you know, people had to share the road, and it was controversial if somebody, you know, ran over a child with their horse-drawn carriage, as opposed to today, when that would be significantly less controversial and it would be treated more as this, you know, terrible tragedy that how could it have been avoided? And in fact, engineering and changing our practice of how we conceive of and build roads would have probably had some effect.
Yeah, in this Lawn article, apparently drivers who did hit pedestrians were often dragged out of their cars kicking and screaming. And I can't really imagine that happening today. And it's obviously not really what a civilized society should do, kind of tar and feather people. But I think there definitely was a lot more appropriation of unsafe drivers back then.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about this.
Thanks for having me.